story must reach just about every life form on the banks. Dawn at sea, a gray void emerging out of a vaster black one. The earth was without form, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Whoever wrote that knew the sea, knew the pale emergence of the world every morning, a world that contained absolutely nothing, not one thing. A long blast on the air horn. The men stagger out of their bunks and pour themselves coffee under the fluorescent lights of the galley, squinting through swollen lids and bad moods. They can just start to make out shapes on deck when they go out. It's cold and raw, and under their slickers they have sweatshirts and flannel shirts and thermal tops. Dawn's not for another hour, but they start work as soon as they can see anything. At 43 degrees north, a week after the equinox, that's 5:30 in the morning. The boat is at the start of the mainline, about 100 miles outside Canada's territorial limit. You generally set into the Gulf Stream and haul into the Gulf Stream, so the previous afternoon they'd set the gear while steaming west into the warm 4-knot current. Then they'd turned around and headed east again, back to the start of the mainline. That gives the entire string the same amount of time in the water and also keeps the boat from losing too much ground to the eastward currents. Billy has hunted down the beginning of the main line with the radio beacon signals and now sits, bow toward America, ready to haul. Haulback is less dangerous than setting out, because the hooks are coming inboard rather than going outboard, but the main line still gets pulled at considerable velocity out of the water. The hooks can whiplash over the rail and snag people in all kinds of horrible ways. One crewman took a hook in the face that entered under his cheekbone and came out his eye socket. To make matters worse, the boat is rarely a stable platform and rarely dry. Keeping one's feet while 18 inches of deck slop pour out the scuppers can require the balance of an iron worker in a sleet storm. Nevertheless, you're hauling up your lottery ticket, and even the most jaded deckhand wants to know what he's hit. The line has been unhooked from the stern guide ring and now comes on board through a cutout in the starboard rail and into the overhead block. The captain steers the boat from an auxiliary helm on deck and runs up to the wheelhouse from time to time to check the radar for other boats in their path. The man at the line is called the hauler, and it's his job to unclip the gangens and hand them back to the coiler, who pulls the bait off and wraps them around the leader cart. Being a hauler is a high-stress job. One hauler described having to pry his fingers off the hydraulic lever at the end of the day because he was so tense. Haulers are paid extra for the trip and are chosen because they can unclip a gangen every few seconds for 4 hours straight. A hooked swordfish puts a telltale heaviness in the line. And when the hauler feels that, he eases off on the hydraulic lever to keep the hook from tearing out. As soon as the fish is within reach, two men swing gaff hooks into his side and drag him on board. If the fish is alive, one of the gaffers might harpoon him and haul him up on a stouter line to make sure he doesn't get away. Then the fish just lies there, eyes bulging, mouth working open and shut. If it's a good haul, there are sometimes three or four half-dead swordfish sloshing back and forth in the deck wash, bumping into the men as they work. A puncture wound by a swordfish bill means a severe and nearly instantaneous infection. As the fish are brought on board, their heads and tails are sawn off and they're gutted and put on ice in the hold. Mako shark eat pretty much what swordfish do, so occasionally longliners haul mako up as well. They're dangerous, though. A mako once bit Murph so badly that he had to be helicoptered back to shore. Touching even a severed mako head can trigger it to bite. The rule for mako is that they're not considered safe until they're on ice in the hold. For that reason, some boats don't allow live Mako on board. If one is caught, the gaffer pins him against the hull while another crew member blows his head open with a shotgun. Then he's hauled on board and gutted. "We fish too far out to take any chances," says a former crew member of the Hanna Boden. "You're out of helicopter range and help is 2 days' drive to the westward. If you're still alive when we get there, we'll take you to a Newfoundland hospital, and then your troubles have just begun." A longliner might pull up 10 or 20 swordfish on a good day, 1 ton of meat. The most Bob Brown has ever heard of anyone catching was 5 tons a day for 7 days, 70,000 pounds of fish. That was on the Hanna Boden in the mid-80s. The lowest crew member made $10,000. That's why people fish. That's why they spend 10 months a year inside 70 feet of steel plate. For every trip like that, though, there's a dozen busts. Fish are not distributed equally throughout the water column. They congregate in certain areas. You have to know where those areas are. You generally set westward into the current. With a thermocline scope, you get temperature readings at different depths. With a Doppler, you get the velocity and direction of subsurface currents at 3 different levels. You want to set in fast water because the gear covers more area. You might anchor one end of the gear in cold water, which moves more slowly, because then you know where to find it. You want to hang the bait between layers of warm and cold water because the food chain tends to collect there. Squid feed on cold water plankton, and swordfish dart out of pockets of warm Gulf Stream water to feed on the squid. Warm water eddies that spin off the Gulf Stream into the North Atlantic are particularly good places to fish. Captains track them down with daily surface temperature maps from NOAA weather satellites. Finally, you want to avoid the dark of the moon when you plan your trips. No one knows why, but for several days before and after, the fish refuse to feed. Swordboat captains are required by law to keep records of every position fished, every set made, every fish caught. Not only does this help determine whether the boat is adhering to federal regulations, but it allows marine biologists to assess the health of the swordfish stock. Migratory patterns, demographic shifts, mortality rates. It can all be inferred from catch logs. In addition, observers for the National Marine Fisheries Service occasionally accompany boats offshore to get a better understanding of the industry they're charged with regulating. On August 18, 1982, the principal planner for the Massachusetts Coastal Zone Management Program, Joseph Pelzarski, left on such a trip. He steamed out of New Bedford aboard the Tiffany Vance, a California longliner that was going to try gillnetting off Georgia's bank. The gillnet was new to the East Coast, and Pelzarski wanted to see how it worked. Spotter planes, as it turned out, reported almost no swordfish on Georgia's, but infrared satellite imagery revealed an enormous warm water eddy at the tail of the banks. Alex Bueno, the ship's captain, decided to try longlining up north, and Pelzarski went with him. Pelzarski's account had almost no impact on gillnet regulations. They made just one set and caught just one fish. But it gave government biologists and statisticians one of their few glimpses of life on a longliner. The FV Tiffany Vance arrived in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, at first light on August 21st. We left that afternoon at 5:30 p.m. with fuel and supplies and were escorted out of the harbor by dolphins riding the bow wake. 2 Spanish fishing vessels, a crewman on the Tiffany Vance was from Spain, were sighted heading west. Numerous container vessels were seen heading towards Canada. We arrived on the tail of the banks on August 25th. The water temperature was constantly monitored for edges where cold and warm water meet. On August 26th, the captain found good water as well as an open area among the other swordfish longliners, and we were to set that evening. The set out took an hour and a half, and 500 hooks were used. Haulback began at 5:10 a.m., with the pulling on board of the high flyer and radio beacon. Yankee hooks and traps were coiled and boxed as they came on board, and monofilament hooks were wound on reels. The captain, steering and throttling the boat, fishes the long line for weight. The first fish was a swordfish. With its bill breaking the water's surface and then rolling on its back, dead, it was hauled to the vessel on the long line. Gaffed, it's pulled aboard, its sword sawed off, and the fish is cleaned. The crew checks the stomach contents and feels the internal body temperature for clues as to what type of water the fish has been in. Most of the swordfish were feeding on squid. The next 2 days of fishing took place in the same general area south of the tail of the banks. On the second day, we caught 11 swordfish, 4 blue sharks, 1 mako shark, 1 sea turtle, released alive, and 1 skate. We kept the mako in addition to the swordfish. The third day, during set out, we had a gear conflict. Despite efforts by captains to establish berths and to contact all area boats on gear positions, we crossed a long line. Our vessel stabilizers, which hang from outriggers about 18 feet below the surface, caught on a long line. The port stabilizer held fast, but the starboard stabilizer, which is composed of lead and steel, left the water and slammed into the bait box just inches from a seaman. To escape gear conflicts and the increased traffic, we moved northeast over the Newfoundland seamounts. The next fishing day, August 30th, 31st, was fairly routine. The captain set out a lesser number of hooks, 300, because the water wasn't quite right, flat water. Despite this, we caught 9 swordfish. During haulback, we lost the gear for an hour due to the mainline parting. After haulback, the captain, in order to find better waters, steamed all night and into the northeast approximately 170 miles toward the Flemish Cap. Whales were seen in the distance. On September 4th, we set out 400 hooks, and the catch consisted of 12 swordfish, 1 mako shark, 3 lancet fish, 3 skates, 1 blue shark, and a leatherback turtle, which was released alive. On the night of September 5th, the captain rendezvoused with the swordfish vessel Andrea Gale so I could get home. The vessels tied stern to stern and transferred my gear on a second line. Then the vessels untied, and the Andrea Gale aligned her starboard side to the stern of the Tiffany Vance, and I swam the 30 yards to the Andrea Gale. They pulled me on board, and 2 days later we landed at the port of Buren, Newfoundland. The owner of the Andrea Gale, Robert Brown, who flew to Newfoundland to replace malfunctioning generators, flew us home to Beverly Airport on September 9th, 1982. The Tiffany Vance arrived in New Bedford on October 18th, 63 days at sea, with 25,000 pounds of swordfish. Swordfish fishermen, in particular the Grand Banks fishermen, are at sea for extended periods of time without communication with the mainland. An opportunity to study short-term culture shock is available among these fishermen and should be undertaken. Through the end of September and the first week in October, the crew of the Andrea Gale set out their gear, steam back, haul it up, and set it out again. The days are hot, and the men are in T-shirts on deck, their skin curing to a salt-streaked brown in the afternoon sun. In the evening, they put on jackets and sweatshirts and work the bait table with their hoods pulled up. The light angles and reddens and finally sinks into darkness with the deck lights ruining the stars and the sharp cold air digging at memories of the New England fall. Around 10 o'clock, the men finish up and pitch into their bunks for a few hours' sleep. To a fisherman, the Grand Banks are as distinct and recognizable as, say, the Arizona deserts or the swamps of Georgia. They have their own particular water, light, wildlife, feel. No blue water fisherman could ever wake up on the Grand Banks and think he was off Georgia's, say, or Long Island. Cliffs of fog move in and smother the boats for weeks at a time. Winter cold fronts come howling down off the Canadian Shield and make the water smoke. The sea is so rich with plankton that it turns a dull green-gray and swallows light rather than reflects it. Petrels and shearwaters circle the boats hundreds of miles from land. Great skuas swoop over the waters, rasping ha-ha-ha at their empty world. Prehistoric-looking creatures called beaked whales spook the crews of fog-bound boats. Killer whales range up and down the long lines, eating, strangely enough, only the pectoral fins of blue sharks. Billy's fishing about 200 miles east of the tail, near a set of shallows known as the Newfoundland Seamounts. On the horizon, he can occasionally make out the white pilot house of a boat called the Mary T, captained by a Florida man named Albert Johnston. Johnston and Billy fish end for end for about a week, setting their gear southwestward in two great parallel lines. The lines stitch back and forth across slight temperature breaks to anchor the gear in the slower-moving cold water. From time to time, they see each other during the haulback, but mostly they're just snowy images on each other's radar screens. Sword boats on the high seas don't socialize much. One would think they would. My God, all that emptiness. But generally, they'd rather socialize in a bar room or in bed with their wives. A waterfront joke. What's the second thing a fisherman does when he gets home? Puts down his bags. Captains have been known to pull one steel bird out of the water on the trip home just because it slows them down by half a knot. Over the course of a week, that means 12 more hours until they get home. 4 or 5 days into October, Johnston hauls his last set and tells the rest of the fleet he's heading in. He says he'll radio the weather conditions back as he goes. The boat rolls along atop an old decayed swell, and the crew catch up on their sleep and take turns at the helm. A new moon rises behind them on October 7th, and they follow its pale suggestion all through the day until late that afternoon. The sunset is a bloody rust red on a sharp autumn horizon, and the night comes in fast, with a northwest wind and a sky riveted with stars. There's no sound but the smack of water on steel and the heavy gargle of the diesel engine. The Mary T makes port in Fairhaven, Massachusetts on October 12th, after more than a month at sea. Fairhaven is a smaller version of New Bedford, which sits half a mile away across the Acushnet River. Both cities are tough, bankrupt little places that never managed to diversify during the century-long decline of the New England fishing industry. If Gloucester is the delinquent kid who's had a few scrapes with the law, New Bedford is the truly mean older brother who's going to kill someone one day. One New Bedford bar was the scene of an infamous gang rape. Another was known to employ a Doberman pincher as a bouncer. A lot of heroin passes through New Bedford, and a lot of sword fishermen get in trouble there. One of Johnston's crew drew a $13,000 check in New Bedford and returned a week later without any shoes. Johnston ties up at Union Wharf alongside McLean's Seafood and North Atlantic Diesel. McLean's is a battered two-story building with cement floors for draining fish blood and a rabbit warren of offices upstairs where deals are cut. Dark, wild-haired young men stomp around in rubber boots and shout to each other in Portuguese as they heave fish around the room. With long knives, they loin the fish, carve the meat off the bones, and then seal it in vacuum bags and load it onto trucks. A good worker can loin a full-sized fish in 2 minutes. McLean's moves 2 million pounds of swordfish a year and 1 million pounds of tuna. They fly it overseas, ship it around the country, and sell it to the corner store. Johnston's boat takes most of a day to unload. The next day, he settles the accounts and starts fitting the boat out again. Food, diesel, water, ice, repairs, the usual. The faster the turnaround, the better. Not only will his crew be more likely to survive New Bedford's charms, but it's getting late in the season to head out to the Grand Banks. The longer you wait, the worse the storms are. You get in that kind of weather, and if anything goes wrong, if a hatch busts off or one of the outriggers gets tangled up, you can really be in trouble, says Johnston. Some of the guys get to where they feel invincible, but they don't realize that there's a real fine line between what they've seen and what it can get to. I know a guy who lost a 900-foot boat out there. It broke in half and sank with 30 men. Sure enough, Johnston's still fitting out when the first ugly weather blows through. It's a double low that grinds off the coast and cranks the wind around to the southwest. The storm intensifies as it plows out to sea and catches Billy one morning while he's hauling back. The wind is 30 knots, and the waves are washing over the deck, but they can't stop working until the gear is in. Late in the morning, they get slammed. It's a rogue wave, steep, cresting, and maybe 30 feet high. It avalanches over the decks and buries the Andrea Gale under tons of water. One moment, they're at the hauling station tending the line. The next, they're way over on their side. Heavily, endlessly, the Andrea Gale rights herself, and Billy brings her around into the weather and checks for damages. The batteries have come out of their boxes down in the engine room, but that's about it. That evening, Billy radios Charlie Johnson of the Seneca to tell him what happened. Charlie's in Bay Bulls, Newfoundland, getting a crankshaft fixed, and Billy calls him every evening to keep him updated on the fleet. "Jesus, we took a hell of a wave," Billy says. "We went way over on our side. I didn't think we'd make it back up." They discuss the weather and the fishing for a few minutes and then sign off. The story of the wave doesn't sound good to Charlie Johnson. The Andrea Gale's known as a tough little boat and shouldn't go over that easily. Not with a bird in the water and 20,000 pounds of fish in the hold. "I didn't want to say anything, but it didn't seem right," Johnson says. "You're in God's country out there. You can't make any mistakes." The Andrea Gale fishes east of the tail for another week and does very poorly. The trip's shaping up to be a total bust. A boat can't stay indefinitely out at sea. Supplies run low, the crew gets crazy, the fish get old. They've got to find some fish fast. Around mid-month, they pull their gear and steam northeast all night to a set of shallows known as the Flemish Cap. The rest of the fleet is way off to the south and west. Tommy Barry on the Allison, Charlie Johnson on the Seneca, Larry Horn on the Miss Millie, Mike Hebert on the Mr. Simon, and Linda Greenlaw on the Hannah Bowden. There's also a 150-foot Japanese longliner named the Asian Maru 78. The Asian Maru is carrying a Canadian fisheries observer, Judith Reeves, who's the only person on board who has a survival suit or knows how to speak English. The Mary T. is on her way out, and another boat named the Lori Dawn 8 has just arrived in New Bedford to gear up. Billy's at 41 degrees west, way out on the edge. He's almost off the fishing charts. The weather has turned raw and blustery, and the men work in layers of sweatshirts and overalls and rubber slickers. It's the end of the season, their last chance for a decent trip. They just want to get this thing done. The Flemish Cap. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. Revelation 15. New Englanders started catching swordfish in the early 1800s by harpooning them from small sailboats and hauling them on board. Since swordfish don't school, the boats would go out with a man up the mast looking for single fins lolling about in the glassy inland waters. If the wind sprang up, the fins were undetectable, and the boats went in. When the lookout spotted a fish, he guided the captain over to it, and the harpooner made his throw. The throw had to take into account the roll of the boat, the darting of the fish, and the refraction of light through water. Giant bluefin tuna are still hunted this way, but fishermen use spotter planes to find their prey and electric harpoons to kill them. Giant bluefin are a delicacy in Japan. They're air freighted over and get up to $80 a pound. A single bluefin might go for $30,000 or $40,000. Spotter planes were introduced to New England fishermen in 1962, but it was the long line that really changed the fishery. For years, the Norwegians had caught mako on long lines, along with a few swordfish, but they had never gone after swordfish exclusively. Then, in 1961, Canadian fishermen made some alterations to the gear and nearly tripled the total northeastern sword catch. The boom didn't last long, though. 10 years later, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration determined that swordfish carried a dangerous amount of mercury in them, and both the American and Canadian governments banned sale of the fish. Some longliners went out after swordfish anyway, but they risked having their catch seized and tested by the FDA. Finally, in 1978, the U.S. government relaxed the standards for acceptable mercury contamination in fish, and the gold rush was on. In the interim, fishing had changed, though. Boats were using satellite navigation, electronic fish finders, temperature depth gauges. Radar reflectors were used to track gear, and new monofilament made it possible to set 30 or 40 miles of line at a time. By the mid-80s, the U.S. swordfish fleet alone was up to 700 boats fishing around 50 million hooks a year. The technological change appears to be bumping up against the limits of the resource, as one government study put it at the time. Until then, the fishery had been relatively unregulated. But a new drift entanglement net in the early 80s finally got the wheels of bureaucracy turning. The nets were a mile long, 90 feet wide, and set out all night from the stern of a converted longliner. Although the large mesh permitted juveniles to escape, the National Marine Fisheries Service was still leery of its impact on the swordfish population. They published a management plan for the North Atlantic swordfish that suggested numerous regulatory changes, including limiting the use of drift nets, and invited responses from state and federal agencies, as well as individual fishermen. A series of public hearings were held up and down the East Coast throughout 1983 and 1984, and fishermen who couldn't attend, those who were fishing, in other words, sent in letters. One of the people who responded was Bob Brown, who explained in a barely legible scrawl that he'd made 52 sets that year, and there seemed to be plenty of mature fish out there. They just stayed in colder water than people realized. Alex Bueno of the Tiffany Vance wrote a letter pointing out, among other things, that draggers weren't likely to switch over to drift nets because they cost too much, and that swordfish population estimates were inaccurate because they didn't take into account fish outside the 200-mile limit. Sports fishermen accused commercial fishermen of raping the oceans. Commercial fishermen accused sports fishermen of squandering a resource. And almost everyone accused the government of gross incompetence. In the end, the fishery management plan did not include a catch quota for Atlantic swordfish, but it required all sword boats to register with the National Marine Fisheries Service, a division of the Department of Commerce. Boat owners, who had never swordfished in their lives, scrambled for permits just to keep their options open. and the number of boats nearly doubled, while by all indications the swordfish stock continued to decline. From 1987 to 1991, the total North Atlantic swordfish catch went from 45 million pounds to 33 million pounds, and their average size dropped from 165 pounds to 110. This was what resource management experts know as tragedy of the commons, a reference to overgrazing in 18th century England. In the case of common grazing areas, explained one fisheries management pamphlet, grass soon disappeared as citizens put more and more sheep on the land. There was little incentive to conserve or invest in the resource because others would then benefit without contributing. That was happening throughout the fishing industry. Haddock landings had plummeted to 1/50th of what they were in 1960. Cod landings had dropped by a factor of 4. The culprit, as it almost always has been in fishing, was a sudden change in technology. New quick-freeze techniques allowed boats to work halfway around the world and process their fish as they went, and this made the 3-mile limit around most countries completely ineffectual. Enormous Russian factory ships put to sea for months at a time and scoured the bottom with nets that could take 30 tons of fish in a single haul. They fished practically within sight of the American coast, and within years the fish populations had been staggered by 50% losses. Congress had to take action, and in 1976 they passed the Magnuson Fishery Conservation and Management Act, which extended our national sovereignty to 200 miles offshore. Most other nations quickly followed suit. Of course, the underlying concern wasn't for fish populations, it was for the American fleet. Having chased out the competition, America set about constructing an industry that could scrape Georgia's bank just as bare as any Russian factory ship. After the passage of the Magnuson Act, American fishermen could take out federally guaranteed loans and set themselves up for business in $250,000 steel boats. To make matters worse, the government established 8 regional fishing councils that were exempt from conflict of interest laws. In theory, this should have put fisheries management in the hands of the people who fished. In reality, it showed the fox into the chicken coop. Within 3 years of Magnuson, the New England fleet had doubled to 1,300 boats. Better equipment resulted in such huge takes that prices dropped, and fishermen had to resort to more and more devastating methods just to keep up. Draggers raked the bottom so hard that they actually leveled outcrops and filled in valleys, the very habitats where fish thrived. A couple of good years in the mid-80s masked the overall decline, but the end was near, and many people knew it. The first time anyone, at least any fisherman, suggested a closure was in 1988, when a Chatham fisherman named Mark Simonich stood up to speak at a New England Fisheries Council meeting. Simonich had fished off Cape Cod his whole life. His brother James was a marine safety consultant who'd worked for Bob Brown. Both men knew fishermen, knew fish, and knew where things were headed. Simonich suggested that Georgia's bank be closed to all fishing, indefinitely. He was shouted down, but it was the beginning of the end. The swordfish population didn't crash as fast as some others, but it crashed all the same. By 1988, the combined North Atlantic fleet was fishing over 100 million hooks a year, and catch logs were showing that the swordfish population was getting younger and younger. Finally, in 1990, the International Commission for the Conservation of Tunas suggested a fishing quota for the North Atlantic swordfish. The following year, the National Marine Fisheries Service implemented a quota of 6.9 million pounds of dressed swordfish for U.S.-licensed sword boats, roughly 2/3 of the previous year's catch. Every U.S. licensed boat had to report their catch when they arrived back in port, and as soon as the overall quota was met, the entire fishery was shut down. In a good year, the quota might be met in September. In bad years, it might not be met at all. The result was that not only were fishing boats now racing the season, they were racing each other. When the Andrea Gale left port on September 23rd, she was working under a quota for the first time in her life. Albert Johnston has the Mary T. back out on the fishing grounds by October 17th, and his gear in the water that night. He's 100 miles south of the tail, right on the edge of the Gulf Stream, around 41 north and 51 west. He's after big-eye tuna and doing really well. Muggin' 'em, as sword fishermen say. One night, they lose $20,000 worth of big-eye to a pod of killer whales, but otherwise, they're pulling in 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of fish a night. That's easily enough to make a trip in 10 sets. They're in the warm Gulf Stream water, and the rest of the fleet's off to the east. At that time of the year, it's nice to fish down by the Gulf, Johnston says. You get a little less bad weather. The lows tend to ride the jet stream off to the north. You could still get the worst storm there ever was, but the average weather's a little better. Like most of the other captains out there, Johnston started commercial fishing before he could drive. He was running a boat by age 19 and bought his first one at 29. Now at 36, he has a wife and 2 children and a small business back in Florida. He sells fishing tackle to commercial boats. There comes a point in every boat owner's life, after the struggles of his 20s, the terror of the initial investment, when he realizes he can relax a bit. He doesn't need to take late-season trips to the banks, doesn't need to captain the boat month in and month out. At 36, it's time to start letting the younger guys in, guys who have little more than a girlfriend in Pompano Beach and a pile of mail at the crow's nest. Of course, there's also the question of odds. The more you go out, the more likely you are never to come back. The dangers are numerous and random. The rogue wave that wipes you off the deck. The hook and leader that catches your palm. The tanker that plots a course through the center of your boat. The only way to guard against these dangers is to stop rolling the dice, and the man with a family and business back home is more likely to do that. More people are killed on fishing boats per capita than in any other job in the United States. Johnston would be better off parachuting into forest fires or working as a cop in New York City than longlining off the Flemish Cap. Johnston knows many fishermen who have died, and more than he can count who have come horribly close. It's there waiting for you in the middle of a storm, or on the most cloudless summer day. Boom! The crew's looking the other way, the hook's got you, and suddenly you're down at the depth where swordfish feed. Back in 1983, a friend of Johnston's ran into a fall gale in an 87-foot boat called the Canyon Explorer. 3 lows merged off the coast and formed 1 massive storm that blew 100 knots for a day and a half. The seas were so big that Johnston's friend had to goose the throttle just to keep from sliding backward down their faces. The boat was forced 60 miles backward, despite driving full steam ahead, because the whole surface of the ocean had been set in motion. At one point, the captain glanced out the window and saw an enormous wave coming at them. "Hey, Charlie, look at this!" he shouted to another crew member who was down below. Charlie sprinted up the companionway but didn't get to the wheelhouse in time. The wave bore down on them, slate-colored and foaming, and blew the wheelhouse windows out. That happened to be a particularly severe storm, and it devastated the rest of the fleet. A boat named the Lady Alice had her wheelhouse knocked in and a crew member paralyzed for life. The Tiffany Vance, which had just transferred fisheries observer Joseph Pelzarski to the Andrea Gale the week before, nearly went down with her sister ship, the Rush. The 2 boats were 1 mile apart when the storm hit, way out on the Flemish Cap, and both lost their portside stabilizing birds. The bird on the Tiffany Vance was hung from chain, and without 200 pounds of steel to keep it down, the chain started slamming against the boat. It had to be cut. Alex Bueno, the captain, stripped to his underwear, tied a rope around his waist, and waded out onto the deck with a welding torch. There was so much water coming over the deck that he had trouble keeping the torch lit. He finally managed to burn the chain free, and then he went back inside and waited for the boat to sink. "We didn't even bother calling the Coast Guard. We were just too far out," he says. "There's really nothing to do but rely on the other guys around you." Unfortunately, the Rush was in even more trouble than the Tiffany Vance. She had cable on her birds instead of chains, and the broken cable managed to wrap itself around the drive shaft and freeze the propeller. The boat went dead in the water and immediately turned side to in the waves, in a beam sea, as it's called. A boat in a beam sea can count her future in hours, maybe minutes. Wayne Rushmore, her captain, got on the radio and told Bueno he was going down and needed help, but Bueno radioed back that he was going down too. The Rush's crew went back out on deck and, taking extraordinary risks, managed to pull the cable free of the propeller. For the next several days, the two boats rode the storm out side by side. At one point, the sun came out, and Bueno noticed that the larger waves put his wheelhouse in shadow. They blocked out the sun. By all reports, Billy's having a terrible trip. After 14 sets, he only has about 20,000 pounds of fish in the hold, which is barely enough to cover expenses, much less compensate 6 men for a month of their life. When Linda Greenlaw arrives on the fishing grounds, Billy tells her that he's disgusted and is going to need more fuel if they want to make any money at all. Sword boats lend each other supplies all the time on the high seas, but Billy has a particular reputation for pushing things to the limit. This is not the first time Linda's bailed him out. The two boats rendezvous south of the Flemish Cap, and Linda drops a tow line and refueling hose over the side. Billy comes up bowed astern and ties off the tow line, and the boats chug along, the Hannah Bowden pulling the Andrea Gale while the fuel gets pumped into Billy's tanks. It's a dangerous maneuver. With any other boat, Bob Brown would insist that Linda just tie floats to fuel drums and drop them over the side. But sister ships are a different matter. They'll do almost anything to give themselves an edge over the rest of the fleet. When they're finished, Linda hauls her lines back, and the two crews wave goodbye as the boats draw apart. Half an hour later, they're just white squares on each other's radar screens. The fuel is just the beginning of Billy's problems, though. Throughout the trip, he's been having trouble getting the ice machine to work properly. Ordinarily, it's supposed to pump out 3 tons of ice a day, but the compressor is malfunctioning and cannot even handle half that. Day by day, in other words, the quality of the fish is starting to drop. A loss of just 50 cents a pound would mean $20,000 off the value of the catch. That could only be offset by catching more fish, which in turn means staying out even longer. It's a classic cost-benefit dilemma that fishermen have agonized over for centuries. And then there's the crew. They get ugly at about the same rate as badly iced fish. By the end of a long trip, they may be picking fights with one another, hoarding food, ostracizing the new members, acting in short like men in prison, which in some ways they are. There are stories of sword boats coming into port with crew members manacled to their bunks or tied to the headstay with monofilament line. It's a kind of Darwinism that keeps the boats stocked with rough, belligerent men who've already established themselves in the hierarchy. Billy would never permit that sort of viciousness on his boat. The crew are all friends, more or less, and he intends to keep it that way. But he knows that you can lock 6 men together for only so long before someone gets crazy. They've been at sea 3 weeks, and are looking at a minimum of 2 more. If they're going to salvage anything from the trip, they've got to catch some fish in a hurry. Billy keeps talking with the other captains, studying surface temperature charts, analyzing the water column with his Doppler. He's looking for that temperature discontinuity, that concentration of plankton, mackerel, and squid. In 5 good sets, they could turn this trip around. He knows it. Ice or no ice, he's not going back in until they do. Billy Tyne has the only private room on the Andrea Gale, which is standard for the captain. On some boats, the captain's quarters are upstairs behind the bridge, but Billy's is in a small room next to the head. It's about the size of a private sleeper on an Amtrak train. There's a sea bag full of dirty clothes and a few photos taped to the wall. The photos are of his 2 daughters, Erica and Billy Joe. 7 years ago, when Billy Joe was born, Billy stayed home to take care of her while his wife worked. Billy Joe got used to having a father around and took it hard when he went back on the boat. Erica was born 4 years later and has never known anything different. As far as she's concerned, fathers are men who go away for weeks at a time and come home smelling of fish. The rest of the crew are wedged into a dark little room across from the galley. The bunks are stacked along the inner wall and the starboard hull, and the floor is covered with the detritus that accumulates around young men. Clothes, cassette tapes, beer cans, cigarettes, magazines. Along with the magazines are dozens of books, including a few ragged paperbacks by Dick Francis. Francis writes about horse racing, which seems to appeal to sword fishermen because it's another way to win or lose huge amounts of money. The books get passed around the fleet at about 400 miles an hour, as one sword fisherman put it, and they've probably been to the Grand Banks more times than the men themselves. Most fishermen tape photos of their girlfriends to the wall, alongside pages ripped from Penthouse and Playboy, and the crew of the Andrea Gale are undoubtedly no different. The galley is the largest room on the boat, other than the fish hold. At first glance, it could almost be a kitchen in a house trailer. Wood veneer, fluorescent panel lights, cheap wood cabinets. There's a 4-burner gas stove, an industrial stainless steel refrigerator, and a formica table angled into the forward wall. A bench runs along the length of the port side, and there's a single porthole above the bench. It's too small for a man to wiggle out of. A door at the aft end of the galley exits into a small holding area and a companionway that goes down into the engine room. The companionway is protected by a watertight door that screws down securely with 4 steel dogs. The forecastle and pilot house doors are watertight as well. In theory, the entire forward end of the boat can be sealed off, with the crew inside. The engine, an 8-cylinder, 365-horsepower turbocharged diesel, is slightly more powerful than the largest tractor-trailer rigs on the highway. The engine was refurbished in 1989 because the boat flooded at dock after a discharge pipe froze, cracking the weld. The engine drives a propeller shaft that runs through a cutout in the aft bulkhead of the compartment and through the fish hold to the stern of the boat. Most boats have a gasket that seals the prop as it passes through the bulkhead, but the Andrea Gale does not. This is a weak point. Flooding in the fish hold could conceivably slosh forward and kill the engine, crippling the boat. The machinery room sits just forward of the engine and is crammed with tools, spare parts, lumber, old clothes, a backup generator, and 3 bilge pumps. The job of the pumps is to lift water out of the hold faster than it comes in. In the old days, crews would be at the hand pumps for days at a stretch, and ships went down when the storms outlasted the men. The tools are stored in metal lockboxes on the floor and include just about everything you'd need to rebuild the engine. Vice grips, pry bar, hammer, crescent wrenches, pipe wrenches, socket wrenches, Allen wrenches, files, hacksaw, channel lock plugs. pliers, bolt cutters, ball-peen hammer. Spare parts are packed in cardboard boxes and stacked on wooden shelves. Starter motor, cooling pump, alternator, hydraulic hoses and fittings, V-belts, jumper wires, fuses, hose clamps, gasket material, nuts and bolts, sheet metal, silicone rubber, plywood, screw gun, duct tape, lube oil, hydraulic oil, transmission oil, and fuel filters. Boats try at all costs to avoid going into Newfoundland for repairs. Not only does it waste valuable time, but it costs obscene amounts of money. One infamous repair bill amounted to $50,000 for what should have been a $3,500 job. The machinists had reportedly run their lathes at 46 RPMs rather than 400 in order to rack up overtime. As a result, swordboat captains help each other out on the high seas whenever they can. They lend engine parts, offer technical advice, donate food or fuel. The competition between a dozen boats rushing a perishable commodity to market fortunately doesn't kill an inherent sense of concern for each other. This may seem terrifically noble, but it's not, or at least not entirely. It's also self-interested. Each captain knows he may be the next one with the frozen injector or the leaking hydraulics. Diesel fuel on the Andrea Gale is carried in a pair of 2,000-gallon tanks along either side of the engine room and in two 1,750-gallon tanks at the stern. There are also 30 plastic drums lashed to the whaleback with another 1,650 gallons of fuel. Each one has AG painted on them in white lettering. 2,000 gallons of fresh water are stored in two four-peak tanks, and another 500 gallons or so are stored in drums up on deck, along with the oil. There's also a water maker that purifies salt water by forcing it through a membrane at 800 pounds per square inch. The membrane is so fine that it even filters out bacteria and viruses. The boat butcher, who's constantly covered in fish guts, gets to shower every day. The rest of the crew showers every two or three. The fish hold is gained by a single steel ladder that drops steeply down from a hatch in the middle of the deck. During storms, the hatch is covered and lashed down so that big seas can't pry it off, although they still manage to. The hold is divided by plywood penboards that keep the load from shifting. A shifted load can put a boat over on her side and keep her there until she sinks. There's an industrial freezer in the stern where the food is stored, and then another compartment called the lazarette. The lazarette is where the steering mechanism is housed. Like the engine room, it's not sealed off from the rest of the boat. Up on deck, immediately forward of the fish hold, is the tool room. 6-liter carts, spools as big as car tires, are lined up behind the staircase that rises to the whaleback deck. The men hang their foul-weather gear along the wall behind the spools, along with anything else that could get swept away on deck. An overhang in the whaleback protects the Lindegren longline reel, and the portside bulwark has been raised to the height of the whaleback and extended 18 feet aft. Huddled up against it are bins full of ball drops, high flyers, radio beacons, everything that hangs off a longline. At the stern of the boat is the setting-out house, a frame and plywood shed that gives some shelter to the men when they're baiting the line. A big sea across the stern might take out the setting-out house. Otherwise, it would probably be protected by the pilot house up front. The deck is steel and covered with no-skid tiles. The gunwales are waist-high and have gaps in them called scuppers, or freeing ports, that allow boarding seas to drain off the deck. The scuppers are normally blocked by scupper plates that prevent fish and gear from sliding out to sea. But when the weather gets dangerous, the plates are taken out. Or should be. The ability of a boat to clear her decks is one of the most crucial aspects of her design. A boarding sea is like putting a swimming pool on the deck. The boat wallows, loses her steerage, and for a few moments is in extreme danger. One longline fisherman, a Gloucester local named Chris, was almost lost in such a situation. The boat he was on was running down sea when she took one wicked sea from hell. The stern lifted, the bow dropped, and they started surfing down the face of the wave. When they got to the bottom, there was nowhere to go but down, and the crest of the breaking wave drove them like a piling. Chris looked out the porthole, and all he could see was black. If you look out the porthole and see white water, you're still near the surface and relatively safe. If you see green water, at least you're in the body of the wave. If you see black water, you're a submarine. "I felt the boat come to a complete stop," says Chris. "I thought, my God, we're going down." We hung there a moment, and then the buoyancy caught, and it was as if she'd been thrown into reverse. We plowed right back out the way we came. Any number of things could have happened to Chris's boat at that moment. The breather pipes could have gotten stuffed and killed the engine. The fish hatch could have given way and filled the hold. A tool could have gotten loose and knocked out some machinery. The wheelhouse windows could have exploded, a bulkhead could have failed, or 30 tons of ice and fish could have shifted in the hold. But even assuming the boat popped up like a cork, she would still be laboring under a crushing load of water. If anything were caught in the scuppers, a hatch cover, an old sleeping bag, the water would have been impeded as it drained off. All it takes is a moment of vulnerability for the next wave to roll you over. Props in the air, crew on their ass, cargo avalanching. It's the end. Every boat has a degree of roll from which she can no longer recover. The Queen Mary came within a degree or two of capsizing off Newfoundland when a rogue wave burst her pilot house windows 90 feet up. She sagged on her beam ends for an agonizing minute before regaining her trim. Two forces are locked in combat for a ship like that: the downward push of gravity and the upward lift of buoyancy. Gravity is the combined weight of the vessel and everything on it, crew, cargo, fishing gear, seeking the center of the earth. Buoyancy is the force of all the enclosed air in the hull trying to rise above water level. On a trim and stable ship, these two forces are equal and cancel each other out along the center line. But all this changes when a boat gets shoved over onto her side. Instead of being lined up, the two forces are now laterally offset. The center of gravity stays where it is, but the center of buoyancy migrates to the submerged side, where proportionally more air has been forced below the waterline. With gravity pushing down at the center, and buoyancy pushing up from the submerged side, the ship pivots on her center and returns to an even keel. The more the ship heels, the farther apart the two forces act, and the more leverage the center of buoyancy has. To greatly simplify, the lateral distance between the two forces is called the righting arm, and the torque they generate is called the righting moment. Boats want a big righting moment. They want something that will right them from extreme angles of heel. The righting moment has three main implications. First of all, the wider the ship, the more stable she is. More air is submerged as she heels over, so the righting arm is that much longer. The opposite is also true. The taller the ship, the more likely she is to capsize. The high center of gravity reduces what is called the metacentric height, which determines the length of the righting arm. The greater the metacentric height, the less leverage there is with which to overcome the downward force of gravity. Finally, there always comes a point where the boat can no longer right herself. Logically, this would happen when her decks have gone past vertical and the center of gravity falls outside the center of buoyancy, the zero-moment point. But in reality, boats get into trouble a lot sooner than that. Depending on the design, an angle of about 60 or 70 degrees starts to put a vessel's lee gunwales underwater. That means there's green water on deck, and the writing moment has that much more weight to overcome. The boat may eventually recover, but she's spending more and more time underwater. The deck is subject to the full fury of the waves, and a hatch might come loose, a bulkhead might fail, a door might burst open because someone forgot to dog it down. Now she's not just sailing, she's sinking. The problem with a steel boat is that the crisis curve starts out gradually and quickly becomes exponential. The more trouble she's in, the more trouble she's likely to get in, and the less capable she is of getting out of it, which is an acceleration of catastrophe that's almost impossible to reverse. With the boat's bilge partially flooded, she sits lower in the water and takes more and more prolonged rolls. Longer rolls mean less steerage. Lower buoyancy means more damage. If there's enough damage, flooding may overwhelm the pumps and short out the engine or gag its air intakes. With the engine gone, the boat has no steerage way at all and turns broadside to the seas. Broadsides exposes her to the full force of the breaking waves, and eventually a part of her deck or wheelhouse lets go. After that, downflooding starts to occur. Downflooding is the catastrophic influx of ocean water into the hold. It's a sort of death rattle at sea, the nearly vertical last leg of an exponential curve. In Portland, Maine, the Coast Guard Office of Marine Safety has a video clip of a fishing boat downflooding off the coast of Nova Scotia. The boat was rammed amidship by another boat in the fog, and the video starts with the ramming boat backing full screw astern. It's all over in 20 seconds. The crippled vessel settles in her stern, rears bow up, and then sinks. She goes down so fast that it looks as if she's getting yanked under by some huge hand. The last few moments of the film show the crew diving off the upended bow and trying to swim to the other boat 50 feet away. Half of them make it, half of them don't. They're sucked down by the vacuum of a large steel boat making for the deep. Very few boats ever get to that point, of course. They might take water in the hold or lose their antennas or windows, but that's it. The result, fortunately, is that their stability limits are rarely tested in a real-life situation. The only way to know the stability profile for each boat is to perform a standard dockside test on